According to a new study released by the company Regenerations, two-thirds of 18 to 24-year-olds say lockdowns due to the COVID-19 pandemic left them feeling lonely and fearful for their financial prospects moving forward. These young adults are already wrestling with mental health challenges in greater numbers than previous generations at the same age. Here to talk about this study and what it means for the young people in Generation Z is Jessica Stallings-Holder. She's the president of Regenerations. I asked why her company took on this study and who they spoke to.
Yes, so this study, we measured how COVID-19 was impacting 18 to 24-year-olds. Bob, the reason we conducted the study is that when we learn about generations, we actually look back to lead forward. We look at the major moments and defining moments that happen in culture as they're coming of age. And so when COVID-19 came, we quickly saw this as one of Gen Z's defining moments. And so we wanted to understand in real time, how is this pandemic impacting the next generation's views? Because what generational theory would suggest, Bob, is that those views are enduring and follow us throughout the different decades of our life. And that's why we conducted the study.
Now, this was not the most social generation to begin with. We've heard that there have been studies that show that they spend more time in their rooms than most. So why is this isolation affecting them so much?
Yes, you know, that was one of our most surprising findings, is that pre-COVID-19, really, Bob, there weren't a ton of defining moments for Gen Z. We know that they're the first digital generations and heavily tethered to technology. We know that they're children of the Great Recession, so they're focused on financial stability, and that they're the most diverse generation in history. And so there were some trends that were really emerging and we were thinking about as we seek to engage the next generation. But one of those core trends is exactly what you said. For the first time in decades, we saw this generation that was leaving their room less than previous generations, delaying some of the traditional rites of passage, like even getting a car or a driver's license. And so when the shelter in place hit, one of the core questions my research partner and I were curious to ask is, hey, is sheltering in place even a struggle for a generation that's happy to stay in their room? And what we found is the majority said, yes, this is a real challenge for us. Well, why? What our research showed is the number one thing they missed during the quarantine was their friends. They missed that face-to-face human interaction. And that is the most profound impact that we found in our study, is that the next generation is telling us, hey, we want to connect hashtag IRL in real life.
Were there other concerns besides just the loneliness?
Yes. When we looked particularly at mental health, Bob, prior to COVID-19, we saw that this generation was the most, we're having some extreme and escalating mental health challenges, from loneliness, depression, anxiety, and unfortunately, suicide. So when we study generations, we look longitudinally or over time, and we saw that this generation was on a mental health decline compared to previous generations at the same age. So when we conducted our study, we wanted to understand how will this kind of isolation impact their already snowballing mental health challenges. And what we found was loneliness was the highest percentage that they indicated, 66% that they felt very alone. Anxiety increased for 43% of respondents. Life satisfaction decreased for nearly half of respondents. So that's some of the troubling findings, is that for a generation who already had high levels of those challenges, now they've compounded. The good news, however, is that it did not translate into increased depression or thoughts of suicide.
I'd like to go back to the thing you talked about their life. Are they thinking about their current situation as much as their future situation?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. We asked them, you know, just to get a general feel of how COVID is impacting them today. And overall, Bob, it was a very negative take on this pandemic. So then we asked, so what does this mean for your long term? And they absolutely cited future fallout. 41% said, hey, this is going to hinder our generation over the long term. Their concerns kind of came up in three areas of how this is going to impact them. First is their financial stability. 80% said, I'm really concerned about how COVID is going to impact our financial future. Next was their job prospects at 67%. Followed by our education opportunities. 50% said, man, how is this going to impact our opportunity to get an education? Next was relationship. Interestingly enough, access to healthcare was not a concern. In fact, Gen Z believes it's going to improve due to COVID-19. So top concerns, their finances, their jobs, and education opportunities.
I wish I had that optimism about healthcare. That's kind of cool.
I thought that was so interesting. And, you know, what we found kind of interesting overall, Bob, is that health never came up in any of the open-ended or any of the questions. It was a lot more focused on finances, job, and education opportunities. But the greatest finding is, again, this drawback to tradition over tech, which is a really exciting thing to learn from the next generation.
What are things that parents or educators can do to help this situation other than, you know, just be there?
Yeah, I love that. And I think actually that's the most important thing, Bob, is to be there, to really take time to listen to the stories of the next generation and how this pandemic has impacted them. When you think about it, so many of life's defining moments happen in those early 20-something years. And here's a generation who've missed from graduations to proms to weddings, many milestones. That's a tremendous loss. So the first thing is just to empathize, to listen, to ask questions. Hey, how has COVID-19 impacted your life? How are you doing? One of the great opportunities is to share stories. You know, research shows that story sharing actually unites the brains between the storyteller and the listener, making it this tried and true form of communication. So as Gen Z is sharing what this experience has been like with them, to really listen, to understand, and to empathize. And I think then that allows the opportunity for also mentoring that, hey, I've been through hard times as well, and here's what I learned in the journey. I believe that mentoring and reverse mentoring is one of the most important things we can do as we seek to unite our culture. The second tip I would offer is to offer mental wellness programs and tools. This could be as simple as embedding into your culture tips and drips about the importance of getting sleep, meditation, practicing yoga, deep breathing, positive thinking, to making opportunities available for counselors or connecting with licensed professionals. Really, the mental health piece of the next generation is something that should be very much thought out as students return to school and as young employees return to work. And finally, the thing that I think could be really cool is with all the milestone misses, that we wouldn't just let those go by. And while we've had a lot of cool things like drive-by graduations or signs in the yard, when we go back to school and when we go back to that cubicle at the workplace, are there things that we can do to come around and kind of memorial the milestone, letting go of what was and maybe the expectations that didn't happen, and creating and getting excited about a new vision for the future? I believe right now a lot of people are tired and discouraged and worn out, and this can be an opportunity to actually come together, reconnect, share stories, and re-envision a new and better future.
We've been talking for the past few weeks on the program about how this pandemic is going to be researched for decades, and we really won't know the results of what the effects are for decades too. What are some of the areas that you believe will be researched in all different areas?
Yeah, I think it's going to be this in-person value of interpersonal relationships versus technology. If I were to say after our study what I would want to pulse check, you know, a year out, 2 years out, 5 years out, is that, because, you know, we've got, particularly with the next generation, change rises, right? So who they are, how they're wired, how they're thinking are clues into where we're going as a society. So when we conducted our study and we had a generation telling us only 2% want to learn online, that they don't want to do all online. They don't like Zoom. They want to meet in person. They want to learn in person. They want to reconnect. My question is that just because we've been pent up for a season? Or are we going to swing back to that kind of value of face-to-face, almost back to the basics? Or will we end up somewhere in the middle with this fusion of tradition and technology? To me, that's one of the most interesting things that I think we'll see as we go forward.
What didn't I ask you that people should know about this study or life in general?
Well, I tell you, you know, there was a lot of reading through, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of the next generation pouring out how this pandemic has impacted them. I tell you, it really touched my life and heart, you know, we had almost 100% completion rate, which is really unusual for a study. So this is telling me the next generation wants to speak up. They want to connect. And we have a window with a generation who really wants to connect with us. So how can we meet them where they are in creative or traditional ways? And the final encouragement that I would leave us with is, although a lot of frustration and some negative things came up in our study, at the end of the day, the final question asked the next generation, are they, you know, more anxious or excited about kind of getting back to life as normal, whatever that will be? And overwhelmingly, the next generation told us, oh, we're so excited. And so there's an optimism in the generation that I think we can all learn from.
There are a whole bunch of teachers out there who are going to be appreciated more than ever once they can be standing in front of a classroom again.
Oh, absolutely. And if I may just pause and say thank you to our educators, when you think about all that they have been through and how they've had to shift, adapt, think in new ways, create, and there's a lot of things still unfolding for them. So I just would like to say, hey, thank you, educators. We appreciate you. We see you. And we're just so excited for the future, and we're in it together.
Jessica Stallings-Holder is the president of Regenerations. You can find a link to the study on the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. Still to come, if you need to reopen a college in the middle of a pandemic, it helps if the school's leader is a health expert. We'll meet one next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Research has been recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Open Network about the safety of reopening colleges during COVID-19. An opening editorial to the study was written by Dr. Elizabeth Bradley, a global health expert and the president of Vassar College in New York's Hudson Valley. Dr. Bradley was the founder of the Yale Global Health Leadership Institute and before that an administrator at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She became the president at Vassar in 2017. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn about plans for opening the school for the upcoming fall semester.
You know, the safest way to open colleges is to really focus on two pieces of reducing the spread of COVID. The first piece is be sure that the number of cases that come onto your campus from the outside is minimized. And the second is, once you have a case on the campus, to minimize its spread to other people. And if you can really manage those two pieces, I think you have a really good shot of opening safely.
The Yale School of Public Health led the study published in JAMA Open Network. Two of the study's findings surprised investigators. One is that it is possible to screen for COVID-19 too frequently, overwhelming isolation facilities with false positive results, generating unnecessary expenditures, fueling anxiety, and undermining confidence in the ability of the university to keep its students safe. This is according to senior study author Rochelle Walensky, who is chief of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Division of Infectious Diseases and professor at Harvard Medical School. Second, the frequency of screening is more important than the accuracy of the test. Testing every 2 days, say the study's authors, even with a low-quality test, will avert more infections than weekly testing with a higher-quality alternative. Bradley talks about her published commentary on the study.
The editorial, I think, has one very important point to it that I hope is not overlooked, which is that responding to a pandemic and a viral threat is complicated. And the right strategy depends on what's the location, what's the size of the college, what's the culture, what kind of capacities do they have. And so it's very important for us not to get focused on a single strategy like testing. That's all we need to do. but rather look at the whole and weave together a set of comprehensive strategies. No single one works, but when you put them all together and it fits your environment, then I think we can be successful. And that's why I titled this editorial, One Size Doesn't Fit All.
What is going to be the testing protocol? What do you think is appropriate?
You have to ask the question, what else is the college doing? In the paper out in JAMA now, the focus is assuming a very large college with many cases coming onto the campus from outside every week, and then limited efforts to reduce spread once it's on campus. In that context, you have to be testing very, very often. And in fact, the authors suggest twice a week. I believe, and I am a big believer in testing, but I believe we also need to look at the comprehensive picture of your strategies, because for many colleges, testing twice a week will be beyond their resources and really infeasible. But other approaches can really help, which is what we editorialize about, and that relates to limiting the number of cases that come on the campus. So that's really having the campus be more isolated and not letting visitors on and off the campuses. And then once you are on campus, absolutely the heavy masking, the social distancing, the proper ventilation, the proper cleaning, all the protocols that we have good evidence on really need to be put in place. If you can do all that, you probably don't have to test as often. In fact, our analysis suggests every 2 weeks would probably be fine, maybe even every month, depending on the situation.
And President Bradley, for Vassar, that means once the initial testing, I believe, unless it's changed, correct me if I'm wrong, that there would be an initial test once a student is on campus and then one a few days later, and then it would be intermittent. And as you're suggesting, maybe once a month or every few weeks, depending on what the situation calls for.
Yes, and just to be clear about what the initial testing on, because you're 100% right, Allison, that early testing is the most important time, because you're bringing, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people back to one small campus from all over the world. They really should be negative before they start school. And so we insist that they have a test taken before they get to campus and really within 7 days of the time of arrival, so that we at least have an indication that they have recently been negative. We ask them to quarantine between that test and the time they get here. Then when they get here, within the very first few days, for some people it'll be the first day, it might be the second day, they'll get another test, which should be confirmatory, and then yet again, probably 4 to 5 days after. So by the time they've been on campus, let's say 7 to 10 days, honestly, they will have had 3 tests, 1 before and 2 once they're here. At that point, we'll really know if we have any cases on campus, and we will use our containment strategy of immediately, isolate the person with the case, do the contact tracing as fast as you possibly can, separate, quarantine everybody who's been a contact. And that's really how you keep this contained, which is we're never going to eliminate it, but we are going to contain it.
What about faculty and staff?
For faculty and staff who are coming onto campus every day, there are multiple protocols, one of which is they do a health screen every morning online, and if they don't do the health screen after several days, you know, we have an automated method by which eventually their ID is turned off. So people do have to do the health screen to be able to work. In addition, masking. Our masking protocols on campus require faculty and staff to wear masks at all times unless they're alone in their own office, or if they're outside more than 6 feet apart and stationary, then they can take off their mask. Otherwise, have to have masks and social distancing. So we're counting on that, and I think at an employee and a faculty level, I'm quite sure we'll get good compliance on that.
Just a few students and staff have remained on the Vassar campus since the switch to remote learning in March. Now, with health and safety protocols in place, Vassar has planned for an in-person return, though remote learning is an option. Students who live on campus will have to sign a community care pledge. Bradley, who also is a global health expert, addresses how the rules will be enforced.
Maybe just stepping back for a moment to look at what really do we know from the literature about best practices in getting people to adhere to a new habit, to form a new habit. And really, what our literature would say is the most important thing is that the community supports it, that it's something that people are doing as part of community care, which is very different from punishment or police enforcement, which we've seen in so many contexts backfire. And on a college campus, we have the opportunity to really say, this is part of how we care for each other. So it begins with the pledge, but then it also begins with a lot of communications. We're trying to develop a culture and a practice in which somebody sees someone without a mask, they say, hey, you forgot your mask. And the person who didn't have the mask goes, oh, thanks for reminding me. I mean, imagine if we had a world like that where we were each holding each other, we're counting on each other to help each other adhere to standards that keep us all healthy. And I think on a relatively small campus of students looking to learn, this is a new opportunity to learn that value. And it's really a value of interconnectedness and how we can live together in a healthier life. So that's really our approach. We will, for sure, do a lot of education, restorative practices. Ultimately, if someone is flouting these protocols and just ignoring them, we do have other opportunities. For instance, we can ask students to, now you have to leave the campus and study remote. Or we could ask that of faculty and administrators to say, actually, if you can't live by these rules, you can do your work remotely. So let's go that way. So those are the different tools I think we have to be able to use.
Fair enough. Kind of community accountability, if you will. And, you know, one question I have that I think about is that, you know, I think most colleges are going to be, you know, sending the students home for Thanksgiving break and completing the semester online to reduce any incidences that could return. What about after winter break?
We anticipate we'll have to do the same thing unless, you know, the shape of this pandemic shifts markedly. We will still require a pre-arrival test. And then the two tests to be sure that one is negative, and then systematic periodic testing afterwards. Always we'll do testing of asymptomatic people as well as symptomatic, since that's just so important, as we know. So I think this is sort of a new way in which we're going to live. I think there's no way around it. It is the best practice. It does call into question for testing. We need better technologies, and I know there are many that are being developed right now, but we really need rapid response. We need point-of-service testing, so you can really easily go get a test, do it yourself, and know in half an hour whether you're positive or negative. That kind of equipment, I think, will be more prevalent by the time we get to January, February, and so I remain hopeful for that. One other thing that's really important about our campus, at this time, we really need to draw a boundary around our campus, and that's for the health of the community, that as we're bringing back up to 2,000 students who come from all over, we want to be sure that we protect our town. And so the students, once they're on campus, have to stay on campus. They're not allowed to leave. And we're going to ask non-essential visitors to not come to campus.
Well, if ever a private college wanted a global health expert at the helm, it would be now. I don't imagine you thought you'd have to call on that background in this capacity. Or maybe you did, you know, it's just
no
interesting.
Idea.
Yeah.
No, I didn't predict this, although last semester I did teach global health. And in fact, we did study pandemic. This was the semester before this pandemic. So all my students were like, wow, you were right. So we have... It's funny. I mean, I think most people in public health has known this risk was at us for 50 years, even really preparing for pandemics. So now it's here. We get to really work on it.
Bradley has written an opening editorial to a study just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Open Network about the safety of reopening colleges during COVID-19. Reporting for the best of our knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
So what makes the really good water the really good water? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Water is a powerful tool and an important resource. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Tammy Giovanelli, associate professor of geology at Berry College, determines how experiences can change people's relationship with this life-giving force.
What is the best way to promote clean water for all? To answer this question, first, a baseline water quality assessment must be completed, whereby identifying the physical, chemical, and biological signatures of the water body. These variables include 8 parameters that are considered to be the best indicators of watershed health. This data collection involves extensive field work in remote areas that are often heavily forested. The goal is always to collect as many samples as possible while hiking along the banks of rivers as they flow downstream. Once the data is collected, it can be used to compute a water quality index value. The WQI is reported in terms of a percentage and can be used to easily communicate watershed health without scientific jargon. That is, a WQI of 100% means the water quality is excellent, whereas a ranking of 50 is bad. By using the WQI as a tool to discuss water management with stakeholders, it has become apparent that solving any water crisis must start with the understanding of human attitudes towards their environments. For example, Africans tend to be terrified of the Nile River because they often do not learn how to swim during childhood, and understandably, they have a deep-rooted fear of the hippos and crocodiles that live in the water. Oppositely, the people who live in India worship the Ganges River as a holy entity, even referring to it as the Mother Ganga. Ultimately, people relate to water bodies very differently because their experiences within their environments are not the same. To promote the conservation of rivers, the perceptions towards them must be considered, or the message will not be received.
That was Tammy Giovanelli of Berry College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.